Welcome back to the Deep Dive. To you, the learner listening right now, you know that highly specific, just extremely modern feeling of absolute chaos.
Oh, yeah.
Like when you're watching a child have an absolute devastating meltdown because their character just died in the video game Fortnite.
Right.
Or, you know, you're sitting on your couch aggressively doom scrolling the 24/7 news cycle until your eyes blur and your jaw aches.
Yeah, that tension.
Exactly. Or maybe you're just logging on to LinkedIn and you were immediately hit with that tidal wave of like corporate ego and self-promotion and performative hustle. We all feel it. The baseline of our modern existence can feel overwhelmingly loud.
It really is. I mean, it's the defining signature of the 21st century. We're living in this culture that relentlessly demands our attention while simultaneously requiring us to maintain a very loud, very solid, and highly curated sense of self just to survive the day.
Which brings us to the mission for today's deep dive, because we are looking at this incredible stack of personal accounts from everyday people.
Yeah, a really fascinating mix of people.
Right. We have a symphony violinist, a forensic psychologist, a transit operations director, and a veterinarian. And these individuals are actively taking the ancient 2,500-year-old Eastern tradition of Buddhism, and they are trying to make it fit into their chaotic, hyper-connected, thoroughly modern Western lives.
And the sources reveal a really profound and honestly complicated collision of cultures.
Right.
You know, we're moving far past that stereotypical romanticized image of monks meditating silently on a misty Himalayan mountain.
Right, like the movie trope.
Exactly.
Right.
We're looking at how an ancient operating system is being fundamentally rewritten line by line to run on completely modern Western hardware. And the process of adapting that code is brilliant, challenging, and frankly, very messy.
Okay, let's unpack this, because how do you even begin to transplant a tradition that old and, you know, that esoteric into the 21st century West? You clearly can't just copy and paste the rituals and expect them to function the same way in a completely different society.
You really can't. I mean, translating the text is only a tiny fraction of the battle. You actually have to translate the entire cultural paradigm.
Right.
Look at the experience of Joe, the symphony violinist, from our sources. He studies under a Tibetan teacher who spends hours and sometimes literally days agonizing over the translation of single English words.
Wow, days on one word.
Yeah, just to make sure the underlying philosophy actually lands for a Western brain.
And the distinction that teacher makes between the words mind and thinking completely changes the practice, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, Joe's teacher deliberately refuses to use the static noun mind and instead insists on using the active verb thinking.
Consider the functional shift there.
Yeah.
In the West, we are culturally conditioned to view the mind as this this permanent independent box inside our heads.
Like a cage we're trapped in.
Exactly. A cage.
Yeah.
But by switching the terminology to thinking, the teacher forces this subtle biological realization. Thinking is an action. It's something you are actively doing. It forces the Western practitioner to realize they are actively generating their mental state in every given second.
It's almost like molecular gastronomy.
Oh, I like that.
They're taking the exact same ancient ingredients, but they're using modern science and linguistics to extract just the active compounds, right? Serving it in a completely different format so the modern palate can actually process it.
That's a great analogy.
And to make it even more accessible, Joe's teacher embraced modern tech by creating a Buddha Path mobile app. Joe literally carries his daily recitations and his practice schedule on his smartphone. He just pulls it out wherever he is.
What's fascinating here is how that app reflects a uniquely Western demand for total comprehension.
How so?
Well, in traditional Eastern contexts, simply reciting a chant in a sacred language like Sanskrit or Tibetan holds immense cultural, communal, and energetic value. Even if the layperson doesn't know the exact literal translation of every single syllable, the ritual itself is the point.
Right. You just participate.
Exactly. But Westerners demand to understand the mechanics. They want to know the why and the what. So adapting this tradition often means stripping away some of the exoticism and the ritualistic mystery in favor of pure, direct psychological comprehension.
And Jackie is a perfect example of this drive for mechanical understanding.
Oh, definitely.
She is a veterinarian who identified as an agnostic atheist. She was drawn to the Tibetan bone tradition, which is this fascinating ancient indigenous framework that actually predates widespread Tibetan Buddhism.
Right, yeah.
And she was drawn to it precisely because it didn't require her to believe in an omnipotent outside God dictating the universe.
For Jackie, the tradition operates as a rigorous curriculum for the nervous system that perfectly aligns with her scientific worldview.
Mm.
She points out that the instruments of modern science are only just now becoming sensitive enough to prove what these ancient traditions mapped out regarding the mind-body connection thousands of years ago.
And she uses these ancient energy practices in the most high-stakes, practical way possible. Like, before she goes into the operating room to perform surgery on an animal, she uses a visualization technique. She imagines this powerful healing entity called the Red Garuda.
Yeah.
But she isn't praying to a literal bird spirit in the sky. She's using that vivid imagery to biologically ground her own nervous system, giving her brain a concrete focal point to steady her hands and, you know, manifest clinical confidence.
That synthesis of the esoteric and the clinical is even more pronounced in Jude's story.
Right, the forensic psychologist.
Exactly. As a forensic psychologist, Jude worked in prisons and state hospitals dealing directly with severe mental illness, specifically schizophrenia. And he takes the core Buddhist concept of no self, the fundamental idea that we do not possess a permanent, unchanging identity, and applies it directly to his patients.
Which honestly blew my mind, because in Western psychology, a healthy mind requires a solid ego. Losing your sense of self is treated purely as a terrifying pathology. It's the ultimate disease to be medicated away.
Jude flips that entire clinical paradigm on its head. In Buddhism, the dissolution of the self isn't a disease. No self is considered the ultimate truth of reality.
Wow.
So instead of just medicating a patient to forcefully shove their fractured identity back into a socially acceptable box, Jude uses his Buddhist framework to approach their terrifying loss of identity with radical empathy.
Because he sees it differently.
Right. He recognizes that his schizophrenic patients are experiencing a chaotic, uncontrolled version of a profound spiritual state. It fundamentally changes how he interacts with them, blending Eastern philosophy into the darkest trenches of Western clinical psychology.
And his wife, Emma, she works as a director in public transportation. She takes those exact same ancient philosophies and applies them to the living room.
The Fortnite story.
Yes. Going back to that Fortnite meltdown,
mm-hmm.
When her kids are screaming and crying because their digital character died, she doesn't just yell at them to quiet down, and she doesn't invalidate their feelings by saying, you know, it's just a game. She applies the Buddhist concept of impermanence.
She acknowledges that the suffering her child is experiencing is entirely real in that specific moment.
Right.
But rather than getting swept up in their emotional storm, she uses her practice to observe the tantrum simply as weather.
Mm.
She teaches her kids to notice the intense anger, to feel it without judgment, and to watch it inevitably pass. Because no emotion is permanent.
But wait, I have to push back here.
Okay, go ahead.
If we take this ancient, deeply mystical religion and completely sanitize it to fit Western science or to optimize our spiritual confidence or just to hack our parenting styles,
yeah,
don't we risk losing the magic entirely? Doesn't this just become another sterile Silicon Valley self-improvement hack?
That is the critical tension at the heart of Western Buddhism. But if you were to ask practitioners like Jackie or Jude, they would argue that the application itself is the magic.
Yeah.
For them, it is not about stripping the tradition of its profound depth. It's about taking its deepest truths off the meditation cushion and deploying them onto the modern battlefield of the mind. True mysticism, in their view, isn't about escaping to a fantasy realm. It is making the esoteric undeniably functional when you're facing a screaming toddler or a life or death surgery.
Okay, fair enough. But merging the East and West isn't always a smooth, highly functional integration, right? There's some serious structural friction when strict Eastern hierarchy meets deeply ingrained Western individualism.
Friction is putting it mildly. The sources highlight significant, sometimes very painful growing pains, particularly around the Eastern concept of guru devotion.
Right.
In a traditional Tibetan context, total spiritual and physical submission to a teacher is culturally congruent. The community understands it, and there are unspoken cultural safety nets. But Jude acutely notes that in the West, demanding total submission to an authority figure immediately raises massive blinking red flags about exploitation and abuse of power.
Yeah, and Jude compares it directly to Western psychotherapy. Like, in a therapy session, the therapist holds an immense amount of psychological power over the patient.
Exactly.
Because of that imbalance, we have incredibly strict, legally enforced ethical boundaries to prevent harm. But in many of these newly imported spiritual communities, those boundaries simply do not exist.
And that lack of infrastructure, leads directly to the heartbreaking account from Kim. She was part of the Sangha, which isn't just a casual meditation club, by the way. In Eastern traditions, the Sangha is the sacred community. It's a core pillar of your spiritual refuge.
Right.
But her entire Sangha shattered due to a Me Too scandal involving their teacher.
It completely devastated the members. I mean, people who were recovering from severe addiction, who looked at that community as their only safe haven, watched the whole thing collapse overnight because the fallible human being at the top abused their unchecked power.
As Kim's new teacher later pointed out to her, Western Buddhism is still in its absolute infancy. We simply do not have the cultural infrastructure or the institutional checks and balances to handle these intense power dynamics safely.
Yeah.
Westerners often make the mistake of taking deeply flawed human teachers and placing them on divine, infallible pedestals, expecting absolute perfection. And when reality inevitably sets in, the crash is incredibly destructive.
And the culture clash is just as intense on an individual level. Think about Jude's struggle with what he calls the LinkedIn ego.
Oh, that's such a good point.
Right. Because to survive, pay your mortgage, and advance in Western corporate America, you're basically required to project this massive, highly curated, self-important ego. You have to constantly network, brand yourself, brag about your achievements. And then he comes home, sits on his meditation cushion, and tries to practice the total dissolution of the ego.
The whiplash.
The psychological whiplash of code-switching your actual soul every day sounds exhausting.
It is pure cognitive dissonance. Society pays you to be a very loud, solid self from 9 to 5, and then you spend your evenings trying to systematically dismantle that exact same construct.
And that friction extends straight to the dinner table. Both Jude and Emma were raised by strict Catholic immigrant mothers. Jude's mom is from India and Emma's is from El Salvador.
Yay.
They talk openly about the intense social hits you take in the West when you leave your family's generational faith. They're constantly navigating this underlying tension, sometimes just trying to subtly pass as Catholic during family holidays, hoping their parents don't ask uncomfortable questions about baptizing the kids.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights a fundamental truth about how the tradition is manifesting here. Buddhism in the West is highly, almost aggressively, individualistic.
How so?
Well, in Asia, the practice is heavily collectivist. It's woven into the fabric of the broader community, the seasonal festivals, the extended family structure. In the West, people often treat it as a solo pursuit.
And Donovan's source captures that perfectly. He notes that in his particular Western meditation group, the lineage and stepwise requirements are completely fluid. There's no formal, rigid path.
Right. Just pick what works.
Exactly. It totally reflects the modern Western consumer demand for personalization and individual freedom. But as Kim pointed out after her Sangha collapsed, that heavy individualism can make the modern Buddhist experience feel incredibly isolating.
So if the practice causes tension with our families, completely contradicts our corporate identities, and suffers from institutional growing pains, why are so many Westerners desperately turning to it?
Because the modern world is fundamentally overwhelming, and they are looking for a refuge. Which brings us to Aaron. His story is intense.
It really is.
Aaron is a college student who picked up a yoga book and decided, at 18 years old, to recklessly try the advanced breathing exercises in the back. Without any guidance, he triggered a spontaneous Kundalini awakening.
And to understand what that means, you have to realize he didn't just feel a little relaxed. A Kundalini awakening is an intense, sudden release of dormant physical and psychological energy in the nervous system.
Wow.
Imagine plugging a 120-volt household appliance into a massive 240-volt industrial outlet. His nervous system was completely short-circuited, leading to what he described as a borderline psychotic period where his perception of reality fundamentally shattered.
His mind was blown wide open, but he was still trying to live a typical American college lifestyle, you know, drinking, partying, participating in casual hookup culture.
Yeah, that doesn't mix.
Not at all. His newly awakened, highly sensitive nervous system violently rejected all of it. He suddenly viewed the entire modern Western society as a fragile house of cards built on capitalist exploitation and empty distractions.
He felt entirely alienated from the Western default. The culture had no framework for what he was experiencing. So he sought out Zen monasteries, finding physical spaces where dedicating everything to intense spiritual practice wasn't considered weird or pathological. It was the accepted norm.
Right.
And realizing how many young people are similarly alienated by the pressures of modern society, he founded a nonprofit called Dharma Gates.
Yeah. Dharma Gates offers young people actual gap years in Zen monasteries. Aaron built a literal bridge to a refuge, because he saw that modern society basically only offers two options to people who don't fit the mold: numb yourself with substances or end up institutionalized. He wanted to provide a third option: go to a monastery and learn to master your own mind.
Importantly, though, for most of the people in our sources, the goal isn't to permanently run away to a cloistered monastery. The goal is to build that refuge internally so you can survive the world.
Like Joe.
Right. Take Joe, the violinist, dealing with the 24/7 news cycle. When global conflicts erupt and the news is terrifying, it is incredibly easy to doom scroll until you are paralyzed by anxiety.
But Joe refuses to just act as a sponge for the horror. He uses his practice to transform the very act of reading the news into an active mechanism of compassion. When he looks at the suffering on his screen, he actively generates the internal intention: may you be free from suffering. He uses his internal controlled state to combat the external chaos, refusing to let the negativity hijack his nervous system.
It completely shifts the dynamic from passive consumption of trauma to active, grounded empathy.
Think about your own life for a second. When the news cycle is screaming at you, or when you are drowning in emails at work, or your family dynamic is pushing you to the edge, what is your refuge?
Yeah, it's a hard question.
Are the standard Western defaults, scrolling your phone for 3 hours, pouring a stiff drink, isolating yourself, actually working for you? Or are they just temporary buckets catching water under a permanently leaking roof?
That question represents the ultimate adaptation of Buddhism in the West. The goal is no longer about retreating to a cave to find peace. It is about taking the monastery with you.
I love that.
It's taking that profound stillness into the grocery store, into the corporate boardroom, and onto the crowded transit system. It is the radical, daily attempt to transform ordinary Western life, whether that is washing the dishes, driving in gridlock traffic, or dealing with a stressful meeting, into an opportunity for profound, unshakable clarity.
So what does this all mean? We've unpacked a massive amount of material today. We've seen that Buddhism adapting to the West is messy, it's beautiful, and it is relentlessly practical.
Absolutely.
It requires agonizing over linguistics to make sure the software runs on our modern brains. It requires aligning ancient energy practices with modern clinical psychology. It means navigating the dangerous pitfalls of Western individualism and surviving the cognitive dissonance of corporate egos, all in the pursuit of finding genuine peace in a hyper-connected world.
And it leaves us with a fascinating historical perspective to ponder. Throughout history, whenever Buddhism moved to a new culture, when it migrated from India to China and later from China to Japan,
yeah,
it fundamentally transformed. It absorbed the local indigenous beliefs, the local philosophies, and the culture of the time in order to survive and thrive. So if Westerners are currently stripping away the traditional mysticism to fit a scientific worldview, replacing physical temples with mobile apps, and turning enlightenment into a psychological tool for surgery and parenting, at what point does this stop being Eastern Buddhism?
Wow.
Are you currently witnessing the birth of a brand new, distinct, exclusively Western vehicle of human spirituality?
That is an incredible thought to end on. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you, keep learning, and the next time you find yourself doom scrolling or watching a Fortnite meltdown in your living room, take a breath and notice how the ancient and the modern might just be colliding right in front of you. Catch you next time.